Okay, Erev Tov, welcome everyone to Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, Part 19, sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'il Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. Tonight we discuss Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov lived a fascinating life. I suppose he's primarily known as the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas for almost two decades, but probably more importantly, he was one of the most sagacious rabbis of the century. My Rebbe, Rabbi Chait, once said that people used to call Rabbi Yaakov the Normalsha Gaon, meaning the normal Gaon. Meaning what? Sometimes geniuses can be a little off socially, even intellectually. They see things differently than other people do, and they're not always relatable. But Rabbi Yaakov was a Normalsha Gaon, a normal Gaon, a normal person. He was a primary Talmud of the Alto Slobodko, whom we discussed last year. He's a source of endless stories detailing his advice to people, his Torah insights, his personal wisdom, all of which illustrate a unique and memorable Torah personality. I said some of his Torah later, before, but Rimin Chamarev, maybe if I have a chance, I'll mention one or two things later as well. Everyone has his favorite Rabbi Yaakov story, some I've told over the years in different contexts. At his first son's wedding, he and his wife walked their son down the aisle. At his second son's wedding, the two fathers walked the chasen down, and the two mothers walked the kala down. At the Suda, a worried, confident ask, did you change your psak? Are you machmir now? Is it better for men to walk down with the chasan and the women with the kala? And he said, no, there's only one rule for making a wedding. The mechutin is always right. So the first wedding, the mechutin wanted the parents to walk down with their child. The second wedding, the mechutin wanted the fathers to walk down. So the mechutin is always right. It sounds very obvious, but trust me, it's not. How many weddings would be spared Agmas Nefesh if both sides took the approach that the Mechutin was always right? I guess that itself would cause a machlokas. He remarried after his first wife died, and at the first Seder, as I heard the story, his new wife brought out chicken soup with a delicious knedel. And she walked away, and his son said to him, let me tell her that you don't eat gebrachts. And Rabbi Yaakov said to his son, don't say a word. It'll hurt her feelings. She worked hard making the knedlach, so I now eat gebrachts. Shalom bayis is more important than gebrachts. So how was such a personality formed? There are many, many svarim written by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Emes Liakov, others written about him, but none more comprehensive than the massive tome, The Making of a Gadol, by his late son, Reb Nosson Kamenetsky, just died a few months ago. It's an amazing work. Really one of the longest books I ever read. Fascinating reading, weird in format. It's about 1,500 pages in all, 100 pages of text, and about 1,200 pages of footnotes, replete with anecdotes and insights and biographical detail about Rabbi Yaakov, and especially many of the gedolim and personalities with whom he learned or interacted and shaped the Jewish world of the late 19th and first half of the 20th century. And as is known, the book was banned, because it revealed what a few felt were too many details about the lives of the gedolim, Rabbi Aaron Kotler in particular. But Rabbi Nosson was opposed to, as his father was, to hagiographies of great people, as if they're all born with beards and they all finish Seder and Zikin before their bris. So I read what was called the Mahadura Mitukenet, the improved version, meaning the second version. And Rabbi Nosson later wrote another book that was not published, but circulated, called The Anatomy of a Ban, where he discussed the mysterious nature of the ban by Gdolim, almost all of whom had not read the book because they do not read or did not read English, but they relied upon tendentious reports of surrogates which is never the best way to do business or render psak, or for that matter, impeach a president, but that's a different point. You can't learn, Reb Nosson held, you can't learn anything from perfect people. You can only learn from exceptional human beings who became exceptional because they worked on their midos for years. So Reb Nosson quoted the Chazon Ish, who said that biographies of Gedolim, if done well, are the best mussar. So, what do we learn from Reb Yaakov? How is the Gadol made? What's his lasting impact on Jewish life? Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky was born in 1891 on a family estate in Kalishkova, but he moved at a very young age to Dolinov, 9 miles east, in yeshiva, where people called after their towns and not their names. He was known as the Dolinover. Dolinov is about 50 miles due east of Vilna. His mother, Etel Danzig, was related to the Chai Odom, not directly though. He had one grandfather, Reb Yaakov did, who was a successful exporter. His paternal grandfather was a wealthy timber merchant, but his mother was orphaned before age 3 and raised by an uncle as his daughter, unaware that her parents were not alive. This, interestingly enough, until she started having dreams when she was 15 years old, that the man she thought was her father was not her father. And she expressed this, and they told her the real story of her parents, and as the man in the dream, now her uncle, her father's brother, understood that it was his father, asked that she not call her uncle her father, uncle told her to stop. But he raised her as he raised his own children, and he married her off to Binyamin Kamenetsky in 1886. The stepfather, uncle, had a grandson named Yaakov Yitzhak Ruderman, 10 years younger than his second cousin, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Of course, Rav Ruderman, famously the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael. So they were second cousins. In fact, they're both named for the same person. Dolinov was a town that was filled with Torah. And Rabbi Yaakov, like many others we have discussed, had a great mind and a prodigious memory that he put to good use. But his father struggled to earn a living. His father was paralyzed on one side of his body due to smallpox. Dolinov was a small town, but the atmosphere was holy. Jews were farmers and merchants and peddlers and artisans. He had a large number of siblings, but not uncommon, but also not generally talked about. He's the only one of his siblings to remain religious. Rav Aaron Kotler was the same way, only he only had one older sister. It was not an easy time. The winds of socialism and secularism were blowing. Reb Yaakov taught himself to read Russian. He read Russian books, something Rav Aaron Kotler did as well, a point that Reb Nosson Kamenetsky noted to the chagrin of the Kotler family. When the family estate in Kalishkov was seized by the Tsar in 1902, the Kamenetsky safety net disappeared. And that's when his parents, who realized the talents and potential of their now 11-year-old son Yaakov, his potential as a Talmud Chacham, they sent him on a long train ride, wagon ride, several different conveyances he had to use to Minsk. He was 12 years old, or 11 years old at the time. They packed him some clothing, and they packed him a pair of tefillin as well, that he'd wear a year and a half ahead when he became bar mitzvah. It's hard for us to relate to that, but it was very common. My grandfather was sent away also and just after bar mitzvah to learn. This is after, Reb Yaakov was before. Minsk was a large city. Minsk was filled with Jews, many Jews. When Reb Yaakov got off the train and was greeted by his older brother, he saw something for the first time in his life. Electricity. Minsk, very interesting, Reb Nosson writes this in his book, Minsk was a city that was filled with yeshivas, as opposed to Vilna. To us, Vilna is the more prestigious city. But he writes that in Vilna, the wealthy people were by and large not religious, wealthy Jews, and did not send their kids to yeshiva. In Minsk, it was the exact opposite. Minsk, the wealthy Jews sent their kids to yeshiva, And in fact, they funded a panoply of different yeshivos that would cater to each different age group. And so a child could go there and find the right chevra. Reb Yaakov was soon admitted to the Capmaker Shul Yeshiva. It was the yeshiva located in the shul of the Capmakers. It was people his age, 11, 12 years old. But he was so superior in learning that he was sent for an admission test, like to the next level, what was called Blumka's Kloys, also in Minsk. He met the Rosh Yeshiva, was impressed. Rosh Yeshiva said to him, "I can't accept you. You're not even bar mitzvah." To which Rabbi Yaakov replied, "I'm here to learn, not to make up a minion." And that quip alone got him accepted, and he excelled, moving up and up and learning with young men older than himself. Tracking him almost from age 14 was a young man orphaned from both parents, known then as Rav Aaron Sislovitcher, known to us as Rav Aaron Cutler, and they'd remain close almost for the rest of their lives, even though their personalities were very different. As charif as Rav Aaron was, Rav Yaakov was good-natured and gentle. He lived with cousins in Minsk, not so happily, but unlike many peers who were just sleeping in the Beis Medrash, it was a better environment for him. He celebrated his bar mitzvah with his paternal grandfather, Shmuel, who'd moved to Minsk just a few months earlier, and Rabbi Yaakov gained a reputation as a prodigy. It was also in Minsk that he first heard a Musar talk given by Rabbi Yitzhak Blaser, the great Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Itzla Petterberger, and that would change his life. He stayed for a few more years in Minsk. You know, Minsk is a much more beautiful city than Vilna. We were there a few months ago, only because it was totally destroyed during the war and rebuilt, so all the buildings are older. But Minsk, interesting, does not have the same reputation as a Jewish city that Vilna had, even though during the time period we're talking about, it was much more Jewish than Vilna was. He stayed for a few more years in Minsk, learning in a variety of yeshivas and kibbutzim, they call different clusters of people learning Torah. And he also read his cousin's books. His cousins were no longer completely observant on mathematics, even read Zionist books like those of Avram Mapu. Mapu was an apikores. He later said that because in Minsk he didn't spend a long time with one Rebbe, no restrictions were imposed on him. And so he sought out what he called every Dvar Chochma he could find, not just in the sciences, but he read Jules Verne, the science fiction writer, Sherlock Holmes, and of course science, math, and history. And he later tried, not always successfully, to incorporate proper secular literature like Shakespeare in the yeshiva curriculum. He said insightfully, you shouldn't think people in Shakespeare's time or the 19th century were more moral than they are today. In fact, they were not more moral. They just had more busha. They had more shame, which is true. During the course of his life, he read Aristotle and Kant. He really was an autodidact. But he also realized that the proximity to his cousins, who were less observant, was not healthy. And so he moved when he turned 14, and he started learning at the Katsavisha, the butcher's shul in Minsk, and he lived there as well. But right after that, his parents moved to Minsk. His father had a hard time finding a job, and he rejoined them, now living in very, very economically strained circumstances, but at least he was with his parents. Even worse, though, his older siblings started agitating for him to receive a secular education and abandon mitzvahs as they had. And fortunately for us, he and a young Aaron Cutler were found by slightly older Reb Reuven Grozovsky, who was learning in Slobodka, and he was sent by the Alta to Minsk to find this prodigy, Aaron Cutler, and bring him back. Reb Reuven Grozovsky came back to Slobodka, and he came back with Reb Aaron Cutler and with Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky. And Reb Yaakov always credited Reb Reuven for saving him. The allure of the Haskalah and secularism was that powerful. It was now 1906, and Reb Yaakov's life will be intertwined with Slobodka for the next 20 years, and with the Alta Slobodka for the rest of his life. So the two men left for Minsk after Pesach for Kovno. I'm sorry, they left Minsk for Kovno. Of course, Slobodka is a suburb of Kovno. They took the train through Vilna. They made their way to what they call Vilium Pola. We know it as Slobodka, which is a suburb of Kovno right across the Vilaya River. So they were interviewed for admission, even though the Alt had sent for them, by the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who asked them to prepare a refutation of part of the Ketzos HaChoshen. And they did. And Rabbi Yaakov learned his first lesson, you're allowed to argue on the Ketzos. He hadn't grown up with that before. And of course the Alter interviewed them, having recruited them, and he didn't accept them right away to teach them humility. He said, come back in a day or two. Well, a day or two passed, and Rav Aaron said, enough of this. Let's just go learn in Reb Baruch Ber's yeshiva, Knesset Beis Yitzchak, just a few blocks away. When that was reported to the altar, so he sent an emissary to chase them down and bring them into his yeshiva, Knesset Beis Yisrael, what we know as Slobodka Yeshiva. It was the first lesson in Midos and in the altar's enigmatic but brilliant educational style. They were greeted warmly by fellow Talmidim, including Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessin, who later became the Mashkiach of Ritz. Rabbi Yaakov took to the learning, took to Slobodka immediately, and he became the exemplar of what a disciple of Slobodka should look like and how he should comport himself. He was first taken aback by the neatly trimmed beards and the short jackets they wore in Slobodka. It was unheard of for Talmud Chacham in Minsk. In Slobodka, they taught table manners as well. And the Alter aided his students' development by regular private time with each of them. And there are hundreds there at any one time, talking to them about their progress, their goals, gauging their Yiras Shamayim, their strengths, their weaknesses, probing their inner thoughts. This the Alter did, student by student, from 10 a.m. until midnight. That was the day. One influence was in davening. Slobodka, as we know, was fastidious about dignity, godless Adam, and the refinement of character to levels of precision that defy human nature. Every midah was analyzed. Every motivation was examined. Not one deed was left unscrutinized. If you remember, we spoke about the altar a while ago. I gave even more examples. One, in Slobodka, they didn't leave their tefillin arm and sleeve dangling like we do, those people wear jackets. You keep your arm out, tefillin, the sleeve dangles. The altar said, that's not how one stands before a king, with a dangling sleeve. So makpid to have jackets big enough that you could fit your tefillin arm into the sleeve as well. Every shirt had to be clean. Every missing button had to be replaced. Everyone's shoes had to be presentable. When they return home, the altar advised them not to daven such a long amida in shul because people consider them not part of this world, otherworldly. Rabbi Yaakov was soon recognized for his hasmada and his good midos as well. It's fascinating. There wasn't much sheer learning in Slobodka. The longest shiur, Rosh Yeshiva gave shiur twice a week for about 30 minutes each. Most of the learning was in chavuros. So they learned to learn and they learned to teach. The longest shiurim in time were the Musa Shmuas of the Alter, which could last 4 hours. And that was his focus. He didn't want to create Talmid HaChachamim, as important too, as much as he wanted to create, he said, mention. People, human beings, good Jews. He noticed how they stood and how they walked, how they talked and how they sat. And he encouraged his students surreptitiously to attend the shiurim of Reb Baruch Ber, just a few blocks away. Yeshivas got along very well, to learn the Brisker Derech. But above all, he knew who to encourage, how to encourage, whom to chastise, and how to chastise them. He knew exactly how to calibrate the Yashav Smol Docha Yemin Mekarev. You're not talking about kiruv in terms of people not on the derech. How to improve people's midos. Who needs a push? Who needs a pull? That was the Alta's genius that really Rabbi Yaakov inherited as well. On Shabbos, Rabbi Yaakov was usually sent to the home of the Alter's assistant, Reber Hirsch Heller, the assistant of Mashgiach, appointed because many years later, after the tribulations of exile and World War I, he would marry one of his daughters. He didn't return home to Minsk for the first time for a visit until he was 16 years old, gone almost 4 years. For almost 20 years, he was close to the Alter. Even when the Alter sent him away with others to help start yeshivos in other communities, he always considered himself part of Slobodka. On Yom Tov, he couldn't afford to go home. So he stayed in yeshiva. Some of the old-timers returned, even spending one memorable Sukkos attached to the venerable Rav Naftali Amsterdam, one of the three primary Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So in fact, he had personal contact with two of them, Rabbi Itzlan and Rav Naftali Amsterdam, observing him up close and seeing the Musar ideal. At age 15, he started smoking cigarettes given to him by another student in Slobodka. He would smoke for 50 years until a doctor told him he had to quit. So he did on the spot. To an incredulous doctor, who didn't think it's possible to halt an addiction in an instant, he answered, channeling a similar story with Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he said, no, once the doctor says I can't smoke, it's now asur. Once it's asur, there's no addiction. Immediate cure. That was Slobodka Musar. He developed a love for an extraordinary knowledge of Tanakh. He completed Tanakh with Rashi by age 9, and Dikduk, and Hebrew language. I'll tell you something I said before in shul. So pasuk in this week's Sedra Vayishlach, Yaakov says, "Vayili shor v'chamor son ve'eved v'shivcha." All these things he has, he's thankful for. Some which will give to Esav, but the trup is unique. "Vayili shor v'chamor son ve'eved v'shivcha." Shor chamor, oxen, donkeys, they are bracketed by a zakev katam. Tzon, oh, you read it yesterday morning. Tzon is separate. I'm not saying anything. Tzon is separate from Shor v'Chamor, but Tzon ve'Eved v'Shivcha, they go together. Of course, the Torah doesn't say Vitzon. So you think, on the surface, Shor, Chamor, Tzon, they should go together, all animals. Eved v'Shivcha not. So Yaakov said, no. The trup is not just a musical contrivance. The trup is teaching us how to understand the pasuk. Shor v'chamor go together because they're animals of shimush. Use them like a plow, a bulldozer, etc. Tzon, eved v'shivcha are really rechush. They're property. They're not something used for something, you know, inherently, but they're property that you buy and sell, you make use of. That's why Tzon, Eved v'Shivcha go together. And he showed in the Emes LeYaakov how you always find in the Torah another three or four times Shor Chamor linked and Tzon separate. Because as an animal, it has a separate purpose. His range of interests was extremely broad. And he once explained that because his father was not a Rav, he was not told what he should or shouldn't learn. And he steadily followed his mind's curiosity. In 1907, he willingly went to help start the yeshiva with Rabbi David Tevel in Malt, who's not far from Prishtina. He went because he was not getting off the new chavrusa, but didn't know how to break away from him. So the Alta saw it and said, go to Malt. It was the first of many journeys from Slobodka, but he never really left. When World War I began, he joined the yeshiva in exile in Minsk, and then he fled to Krynik, to Trestina, to Tiktin, where to support himself in these little villages, he taught Aleph Beis to little children until his Torah greatness was revealed. Then to Lomja, and finally rejoining the Slobodka yeshiva in Kremenchug after the war. Now he was now 28 years old, it was 1919, and reconnecting with the younger Mashgiach, Reber Hirsch Heller, He soon married the Mashgiach's daughter, Itta Etel, and they began to travel back to Slobodka, where the yeshiva was reopening. And here, too, there were lessons to be learned. With his pregnant wife, they took a wagon, leaving Minsk, to travel to Kovno. And the wagon was stopped in another town, Rakov, to be searched for contraband by the authorities who were cracking down on smuggling. So the Rav of the town intervened, told the authorities who the passenger was, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and they let the wagon go. Soon after, the wagon hit a bump in the road, a false bottom fell out from the wagon, and all the contraband the driver was smuggling fell to the road. Rabbi Yaakov was so horrified at the dishonesty, he insisted on being dropped off in the next town, wherever it was. His sense of integrity was so offended. In the 1970s, you may recall, some yeshiva students were caught smuggling diamonds from Antwerp inside their tefillin and arrested. And people started raising funds for their defense, for Pidyon Shvuyim, etc. And Rabbi Yaakov was outraged. And he said they should not be freed and they should not be defended because what they did was dishonest. And as bad, they've made every Jewish traveler with a pair of tefillin a potential suspect. And so they deserve their fate. In the next town, Medyevek, only two Jewish families live there, and they refused to give him and his pregnant wife lodging, referred him to a non-Jew. Rabbi Yaakov pleaded, no avail. They made it to Vilna for Rosh Hashanah, and then he saw this same man being given an aliyah by the altar on Rosh Hashanah morning, and he was outraged. And after davening, he went to Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Rosh Yeshiva, and said, this man refused lodging to a pregnant woman and her husband. As I'll talk to you after davening, etc. And he said, let me tell you what happened to this man. He had once taken in a Jewish guest, and that Jewish guest robbed him of all his valuables. And he swore not to take in any guests. But he had taken in the altar. And to Rabbi Yaakov, it was an example of Avera Goreres Avera. Someone stole from him, and now he's renouncing Hachnasas Orchem. How could that be? He shortly thereafter departed to learn for 6 months in Kelm, where the altar had studied under the altar of Kelm, Rav Simcha Zissel Ziv, the third great Talmud of Rav Yisrael. But he departed, Rabbi Yaakov did, as the altar did, from the regimen of Kelmer Musar, which was much more rigid than the Slobodka Musar. Rabbi Yaakov said it was worthwhile to learn there, everyone should do it, but it really wasn't for him. Every deed was monitored, and that wasn't so natural. So, for example, they were trained not to turn their heads when a door opened. It was a breach of concentration. I remember my father once walked into a cheder in Mea Sharim, and the same rule applied. The children were not allowed to turn to look at a door when the door was opening because they had to concentrate what they were doing. Oh, what happened? So when he came, no one greeted him. And he felt offended. It was a lack of Derech Eretz. And he told them, at his suggestion, they designated one person to welcome visitors. How tough was Kelm? So the davening of the Beis Medrash, the Gabbai calls a Levi or Yisrael, Bimkom Kohen. And at the time, a Kohen walked in. And Rabbi Yaakov informed the Gabbai, a Kohen walked in, he can get the Aliyah, and he was reprimanded for turning to see who had walked into the Beis Medrash. That's how tough they were. In Kelm, they prized Menuchas HaNefesh, calm, peacefulness. Every action was measured, every action was appropriate, very keen sense of honesty as well. It was in Kelm, you hear the stories, people would leave a hat, an umbrella in the Beis Medrash, and they'd find them years later in the exact same place, dusted and cleaned every week, waiting for their owner to reclaim them. True story, I told it years ago, in the late 30s, the famous Kelmer Din Torah, in which each side argued that the other side is right and deserves the money. That's a Kelmer Din Torah. the davening was unrushed. It was in Kelm that the aphorism emerged. They would say that a galach is frum. A Jew has to be erlich. Think about it. Erlich, honest. Frum, external measures of piety. Even a priest could have that. But to be erlich, that should mark a Jew. And that too made a deep impression on Rabbi Yaakov. An extraordinary memory. Photographic memory. He said that until middle age, he didn't understand what it meant to forget something. It was completely foreign to him. So Shasim and Rishonim, of course, they're all memorized. So in Slobodka one year, because he had such a memory, he gave a peer directions home for Pesach. This young man lived in a very small, distant village. It was a very circuitous route. And Rabbi Yaakov explained to him, wagon here, switch the train, another train, etc. The next Pesach, the young man asked Rabbi Yaakov for directions again. And Rabbi Yaakov said, why are you asking? I told you last year. That's how he looked at it. He could not relate to halachas we live with. We just last week, a few days ago, started saying V'sein Talmud L'Vracha. It says, open halachas in Shulchan Aruch. What if a person is in doubt whether you said it? You pass through Baruch Aleinu, and your mind is elsewhere, and now you're, I don't know, at Shema Kaleinu, and you think, did I say V'sein Talmud L'Vracha or V'sein Bracha? He couldn't relate. He said, how could a person not know what he just said? Well, that's the world we live in. Back in Slobodka, 1921, Rabbi Yaakov was an original member of the newly formed Slobodka Kollel, which supported him for 5 years, after which he was to take a job in the rabbinate. Other original members, distinguished Rabbanim, Rabbi David Leibovitz, founder of Chavetz Chaim Yeshiva, Rabbi Zalman Osofsky became the Rabbi Slobodka, brutally murdered by the Nazis in 1941. Later members included Rav Ruderman and others. So the Slobodka Kol merged with the Kovna Kol 1925, right before Rabbi Yaakov left and assumed a rabbinic position, his first and only one in Europe, in Sativian, a small town not far from Kelm, a rural village. Now life in 60 families. Life in Sativian suited him well. He said he had no aspirations for great things, but there was not much to do there but learn. The village consisted of simple farmers, and the only high Torah, high-level Torah he discussed was with occasional visitors. But he had a deep affection for simple Jews, and he developed a reputation for honesty and forcefulness and cleverness with a deep and penetrating understanding of the human personality. Like the altar, he usually knew what to say and how to say it. He knew how to ferret out liars and cheats. And of course, he knew Ehrlichkeit. The local postman, a non-Jew, used to test Jews by giving them too much change in the post office to see who'd return it and who wouldn't return it. And of course, Rabbi Yaakov always did. That's normal, but not this, as Stern heard many years ago. The Lithuanian authorities once entered his home and they saw that he had two stamps torn up. And he was accused of defacing government property. I think the picture of the Lithuanian president was on it as well. And he calmly explained to them that now he intended to mail a letter, but then he found someone who was traveling to that town and who could deliver the letter by himself. But Rabbi Yaakov did not want to deprive the government of the income, so he canceled the stamps on his own. Such a story is too good not to be true. When he realized the village had no doctor, he spent one night reading a medical textbook in Russian, so impressing a neighboring non-Jewish doctor that that doctor retired and came to live in Sativian just to be near Rabbi Yaakov. The problem with this small, poor village is they had little money to pay the Rav, so he lived in dire poverty and penury with his wife and now 6 children. In 1937, he decided to leave Sativian, find a new rabbinic position, but he lost out in Vilkomir. Reb Chaim Ozem offered him a job in Vilna. He declined, and he said to his wife, the only option was to go to America. And it was depressing. He had to travel alone. But years later, the lessons became apparent, everyone who had taken the positions that he was interested in Europe was murdered in the Holocaust with their whole family. It's because he did not get them that Rabbi Yaakov and his family were spared. For instance, you have a little perspective of years and see that sometimes we think something is bad is really not so bad after all. Kol dor rachmana l'tav avid. It wasn't easy. So he officially came to the United States in 1937 to raise money for the Kovna Kolel and to scout out job prospects for himself. But he went to one donor, and as the minig is at Hayom, they give you a copy of the check or the receipt that you gave them last time. He realized someone in the Kolel had inflated the receipts, added a zero, to try to encourage a larger donation. And when one donor pointed that out, he said, "Don't give me any money, I quit." He quit on the spot, and now he had nothing. He found out that the Rav in Seattle had to undergo some medical treatment, so he endeavored to travel cross-country, speaking little English, with stories of Rabbi Yaakov here, very reminiscent to me of the movie The Frisco Kid with Gene Wilder, if you saw it. Also, 19th century European Rav making his way across America to get to the West Coast. That was the movie. He spent Yom Kippur in Fargo, North Dakota, which had a large Jewish community. He left afterwards to get to Spokane, but he needed to get off the train because Shabbos was coming. He didn't really speak English, so he said to the porter, he's pointing to his watch, he said, "Saturday, Saturday." And the porter answered him, "No, Friday, Friday." It's still Friday. He said, "No, Saturday." He said, "No, Friday." And they went back and forth. He finally was dropped off in Priest River, Idaho, spent Shabbos in a hotel, eating just some challah that he had with him. He made it to Spokane Sunday night. Sukkot is a day or two away. He looked in the phone book for Jewish names. He found a Reverend Siegel, called him, spoke in Yiddish. He answered in German. Reverend Siegel came to the train station to pick him up. And of course, Reverend Siegel was a Lutheran minister. Siegel's a Jewish name too. He kindly took Rabbi Yaakov to the local rabbi's house. The local rabbi was a conservative rabbi, the only one the Lutheran knew, something Rabbi Yaakov had never yet encountered. Finally, Spokane's Orthodox rabbi found him, and Rabbi Yaakov was happy to sleep that sukkah in the shul sukkah. Made his way, Spokane's not far from Seattle, made his way to Seattle, where the Rav Rogalanter was about to leave for a few months, and he began acclimating himself, and it was a different world. When Rav Rogalanter returned, he was able to find Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky a job in Toronto, in the Torah Emes Shul, so he made a cross-country trip in reverse. He arrived in 1938, right before Purim. He couldn't yet afford to bring his family over. It's 1938, until wealthy Balabatim, including the father of Joseph Tannenbaum, very famous name, paid for them. And he was always grateful to Tannenbaum, the family, and some other family. They paid for the whole family to come over exactly a year before World War II erupted. It should be noted that his brother-in-law, Rabbi Yaakov's brother-in-law, another one who had married a daughter, Ber Hoshela, the very esteemed Avram Grudzinski, no relation to Chaim Ozer, but he was now the Mashgiach Ruchani in Slobodka, he objected to his sister-in-law and nieces and nephews leaving Slobodka for the wilderness of North America. And he especially did not want the two boys to leave, Binyamin and Shmuel, because they're already learning in yeshiva. But Yaakov said he could no longer bear to be apart from them, and he insisted. And they came. They arrived September 1938 in Toronto. Rabbi Avram Grudzinski remained in Slobodka, and he was murdered by the Nazis in 1941 when they burned down the hospital in which he was being treated. His house in Slobodka still stands. When they found out that Rav Avram was killed, Rabbi Yaakov said, "This is the end of the Musar movement." Rav Avram Grudzinski, that was a figure that he was. It will not be transplanted to America, and in fact it has not been. In Toronto, Rabbi Yaakov began his real career teaching, advising, guiding. He became known as a great Baal Eitzah. And that maybe is his biggest legacy. Some would contend that was his major contribution to Jewish life. He just knew how to guide people, leaders, organizations, schools. He was open-minded. He saw the world through the perspective of the questioner. And fairly rare phenomenon, he was a person who could counsel someone and completely remove any personal considerations from the guidance. And he was strong when necessary, as in many communities then, to some extent now as well, in some places. There was Hefkeris and Kashrus and Gittin and a lot of Chil Shabbos. And he explained that a manhig has to be willing to take positions that might anger people. And he said, that's why God rejected Moshe's entreaties that Aaron was better suited to be the leader of Klal Yisrael. Remember in the Perek Dalet of Shmos, Moshe says at the end of his colloquy with God, send Aaron, don't send me, let him lead the people. And so Rabbi Yaakov said, no, God held Aaron is a Rodev Shalom. And a Rodev Shalom is less suited to leadership. Sometimes you have to lead even if Shalom dictates giving in. You can't always have Shalom. He opposed teaching in Yiddish. He said, why should the Torah suffer because we want them to learn Yiddish? And he realized that in his environment, the purpose of learning Torah had to be practical. Talmud Gadol Shemevi Lidei Ma'aseh. So he made a deep impression on the Taranto community as it did on him. So give one example. Interesting to think about it. In his shul, when he got there, they were against announcing the times for Yisker, like we do, for example, here. Because it's tantamount to encouraging people just to come for Yisker. No, Shachar's 8 o'clock, 8:30, you come 8:30 and you'll know when Yisker is because you're sitting there. Don't say Yisker's at 10:30, Yisker's 11 o'clock. We always say Yisker's an hour ahead of it's going to be anyway. But so it made sense, but people come on time. But then he said on his voyage to America, one Motzei Shabbos, he was standing on the deck, and there was a person walked up to him, not wearing a yarmulke, smoking a cigarette, and he said, what a relief it is to be able to smoke now that Shabbos is over. And Rabbi Yaakov, something didn't compute. No yarmulke. So the man explained to him that his business was always open on Shabbos. And then one Shabbos, he went to shul to say Kaddish for a parent. And in shul, he realized how incongruous it was. Here he went to shul on Shabbos to say Kaddish for a parent. Then he went back to work. Right then he decided to close his business on Shabbos. Rabbi Yaakov said, if a person can become religious through Yizkor, through Kaddish, why can't someone become religious through Yizkor? So maybe advertising the time for Yizkor, you'll draw them in that way. After much pleading, he left Toronto in 1945 to become a Ram at Torah Vadas in Brooklyn. A new chapter in his life opened. He's 53 years old now. Interestingly, he also entertained seriously an offer from Rabbi Belkin to come to Reitz. And he thought about it because Reitz had more students than Torah Vadas. They were producing more rabbis. So he never had the pejorative attitude towards YU that some other Rosh Yeshiva had. For example, when Rav Moshe Shatzkis, the Lomja Rav, who became a Rebbe at Reitz, died, they all went to the funeral. Rav Aaron Kotler went to the funeral at YU, but he refused to enter the building. So antagonistic was he to the idea of YU. Rav Yaakov pulled up in a car, got out of the car, as he headed to the building, as in first hall, he turned left and he caught sight of Rav Aaron Kotler looking at him disapprovingly, about to enter the building. Rabbi Yaakov stopped, he looked to the heavens, held out his hands as if it was drizzling, the skies were overcast, and he said to his driver, let's go in, it's raining. So he made it seem as if he's just trying to escape the rain and not to offend Rav Aaron Kotler. It was an easy transition in Torah Vadas. For one thing, Rabbi Yaakov was a stickler on diktuk, so I've mentioned this story a number of times. First day, first year in Baba Basra, what's the first word? Michal? Hashutafin, all right, the partners. What's yeshivish speak? Hashutfin. So he said Hashutafin, and everyone laughed because the proper yeshivish pronunciation was something else. They didn't know. Rabbi Yaakov did know, but he said he'd never make that mistake again because you had to force yourself to speak the language of the Talmidim, yeshivas speak. More significantly, he objected to Talmidim immersing themselves in brisker svaras, in lumdas, before they had a grounding in the Rishonim. And that was a struggle because he wanted them to focus on mastering the text, learning how to read a Rashi and a Tosfos before they started contemplating the deeper aspects of the Gemara. And he advocated for a broad understanding of Gemara, learning a lot be'iyun rather than a little be'iyun gadol. And he also recognized, unlike Rabbi Aaron Cutler, that most of his students would attend college. So he had to make Talmud Torah intellectually attractive to the bright students. After Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz died in 1948, Rabbi Yaakov and Rabbi Gedalia Shor became the Rosh Yeshiva in Tor Vadas, and he was a dominant figure, training many of the Rosh Yeshiva of the last 50 years, guiding schools in every conceivable issue, and in Tor Vadas, Rosh Yeshiva until 1967. His first wife died in 1954, and he lived alone in Brooklyn near the yeshiva. He ate on Shabbos in Schick's restaurant, like other patrons, because he did not want to inconvenience his children or anyone else. He remarried in 1958, Hannah Ehrman of Toronto, and had a long marriage with her as well. He was an early member of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, but he really was a moderating force on the Moetzes. He saw things, he wasn't a black and white personality. His son said the world was gray to him. So he said Mizrahi considers itself a Torah movement. Aguda considers itself the Torah movement. So perforce, whatever Mizrahi does, Achil Hashem. But he didn't see the world that way. He once said, food for thought, he said it like this: the Christians stole the Bible from us, the Maskilim stole the Hebrew language from us, and the Zionists stole the land of Israel from us. So he meant that all these were integral to Torah, but for whatever reason, the Torah world had become so insular and began to denigrate all three: the study of Tanakh for Galachim, Eretz Yisrael, the Zionists, the Hebrew language for the Maskilim. He held that to be both unwise and unwelcome. So if Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky signed the famous proclamation of the 11 Rosh Yeshiva against membership in mixed synagogue boards, 1956, to demonstrate how important it was to him to draw boundaries. Always remained a pillar of integrity. He expelled a kid from Tor Vadas for cheating on the regents. He expelled another kid for using a forged bus pass. There are infractions that can be overlooked or used for chinuch purposes, but dishonesty was not one of them. That was even worse than a more serious sin. You could commit a more serious sin and not be expelled. But he held Geneva and Sheker have a way of being rationalized, so you have to uproot it. Interestingly, he did not insist on buying glatt meat for the yeshiva, saying somewhat counterintuitively that there was such poverty in Europe that rabbis were pressured to allow very questionable meat as kosher, so there one had to be makpid on glatt. But in America, wealthy country, non-kosher meat is sold to non-Jews, so the loss is not as great. As such, it's not right to expend the yeshiva's limited resources on glatt meat when the regular kosher meat is acceptable. There was a rebellion in the yeshiva at a certain point, but he stood his ground. Also, counterintuitively, he insisted that all the boys eat their Shabbos meals with their families and not in the yeshiva. So it's a good influence. They should see what family life is like. And he insisted that the Beis Medrash be closed at a reasonable hour so the boys get some sleep overnight. I'm almost certain that today none of these approaches are followed any longer. He had seen with his own eyes how bad or irritable teachers can ruin children, remembering from his own youth how teachers would spank children, sometimes, including himself once, unjustifiably. So all this seems obvious, but it's really not. Once, as the story goes in Muncie, he was in the Rebbeim in his office, and he looked out the window, and the children were playing ball. And the Rebbe said, what bittul Torah. And Rabbi Yaakov said to him, on the contrary, don't say that. They robbed me of my childhood because they said I was an Eloi, and they never let me have the normal life of a child. Let the children be children. You could say the same thing about teens. Teens are teens. They're not little adults. You have to give them some slack as well. From his earliest years, he didn't play ball, but he was an expert swimmer, he said, taught by his older brother. And so Rabbi Yaakov was blessed. He remained healthy well into his 90s. And the yeshiva established a summer camp that would be a break from the usual routine. Even the learning was different, but he felt that kids needed a break. Once a famous Rav came to camp in the middle of the day to give a shiur, during the time that was set aside for swimming and sports, and Rabbi Yaakov refused to alter the schedule. He said, no, this is their time to swim, to play. After is also good. He felt if kids don't clear their minds, then they'll break down in the next zman. So what have you really gained with all of this? Contrast that, by the way, with all the learning programs that we have now that are established during intercession, during the summer, as if the primary purpose of intercession is to give the teachers a break, not the students a break. He saw the world differently. The high level of empathy. And the Rebbeim spent the summers in camp. It was a good way for students to see a different side of their Rebbeim, even to play baseball with them, and be influenced by the character of their Rebbeim outside the classroom. And besides the shiurim, he gave Musar talks that people quote until today, simple but refined, filled with Torah and the quest for good midos. He would tell students, for example, going home for Yom Tov, not to flaunt their chumros that they had adopted in front of those who don't. That's also yohara. When some serious students asked that the batlonim be expelled, every base medrash has batlonim, they couldn't take the full rigors of the long day, he disagreed. And he said, no, it's natural for a person with a particular good trait to look down on others who don't have it. It's natural, but it's wrong. And he uses a mashal, he said, there are four ways, according to halacha, to fulfill shal shudis in descending order of preference. Eat bread, cake, fruit, divrei Torah. But on each level, the one who does that, person has challah, he looks down on the level below him. But he said the way of Avram is the way of chesed, to show kindness to other people. So rather than expel the weak students, the stronger one should learn with them b'chavrusa. Some of this sounds obvious, but it's really not. I saw this story when President Kennedy was assassinated. The students were shocked and horrified, but then some thought that maybe they're just too involved in the American scene and it shouldn't have troubled them that much. And Rabbi Yaakov disagreed, and he said, no, that's part of our gratitude to the United States, a Malchus Shel Chesed. And he gave a, told him a story. There was a Jew-hating priest, rabidly Jew-hating priest in Slobodka. And when he died, some of the Talmidim ran to the altar joyously to tell him that this priest was dead, assuming the altar would rejoice. And instead the altar heard the news and he said, Nebuch, man died. And he explained that a person who allows himself to hate non-Jews will eventually hate Jews who are different from him as well. That's a high level, but don't we know that to be true? In 1967, he moved to Muncie, the same year I did, with much less impact, but didn't really retire. He gave shiurim, he established a base medrash in his home, he was involved in Sifta Beis Shraga on Saddle River Road, he lived on Saddle River Road, he was constantly visited by people. Rabbi Wein used to consult him and quote him frequently. He spent his winters in Miami, that's normal for Jews in their 70s, but Rabbi Wein said he would defer many questions people had. You know how it is. I've seen this happen. They'll ask a question, visitors to a visiting Rav, something the Rav of the town had paskin they don't like. What do you think? All right? And sometimes the foolish visitor gives an answer. Rabbi Yaakov would always say, if it's a local issue, ask your local rabbi. That's the answer. Rabbi Wein was Miami Beach then. So I started by saying it was the normal shagon. what's normal? Once in Miami Beach, he was sitting in the park looking at the palm trees. A yeshiva student walked by. Insolence always existed, not just today. And he said, the Rebbe is breaching an open mission of us. That a person, Mahachma Derech, was shown a mafsik bi mishnaso. Person stops his learning to say, Manoi Elon Zeh, how beautiful is this tree? He's Mechai Mishai Benavsho. Rabbi Yaakov said to him, that's if a person interrupts his learning, meaning is distracted from his studies. But if he's looking to discover and enjoy the wisdom of the Creator, that's not an interruption. Listen to this. It's the chemical bank in Muncie introduced the new system wherein people were randomly chosen for VIP treatment. I mean, if they wait in line anymore, they got credit right away, etc. Rabbi Yaakov's name came up randomly. Next time he came to the bank, he was greeted by the bank manager who said, VIP is happy to greet. Rabbi Yaakov was puzzled and he said, why should I get special treatment? I'm just a regular customer. And he declined the VIP treatment. The manager was puzzled because no one else had declined VIP treatment. Your check's clear immediately. Until a religious employee of the bank explained to him that in Jewish tradition, the greater you are, the humbler you are. And that's what Rabbi Yaakov could not accept. In Muncie, it's a very famous story. He lives on Saddle River Road, right across from an old age home for nuns. Today it's St. Zita's home, a convalescent home for nuns. In the late 1980s, a nun stopped a Jew walking on the street. You have the nunnery, it's convalescent, one end of the block, and Beshrag's the other end of the block, stopped the Jew and said, whatever happened to the old rabbi who used to walk here? And they said to him, oh, he died. Why do you ask? And the nun said, because he's the only one who used to say good morning to us. Normal. The stories of his character are legion. He had exquisite sensitivity. Once, a young Rav was talking to him at a Shabbos table, and the Rebbetzin came in with some tea. And the Rav said, no, thank you. And she walked out. And Rabbi Yaakov said to him, how would you like it if you walked into the Beis Medrash to a chavura with Torah that you had prepared, and the people said to you, no, thank you. That's how she feels now. See, don't reject prepared food. If you are asked in advance, if you want something, then that's the only time to refuse. But for her, the tea is a shtickle Torah. How would you have felt? That's Slobodka Musar. This is her brother wine. He insisted that his drivers pay the toll keeper. Remember there was a time, as a toll keeper, or I remember at the George Washington Bridge, you could throw coins in the basket. He said, you have to pay the toll keeper and not throw coins in the basket. It's an insult to prefer a machine to a human being, which is really all we do today. He recognized the changing times, which what made him such a profound Baal Eitzah. He told the teacher in Tarva Das, they had to broaden the curriculum. They couldn't just teach the yeshivish masechtos that were learned in Europe, Zikin mainly, Noshim. They had to give the children the Yerush Shamayim that came from brachos and davening and Shabbos, etc. After the death of Aaron Cutler, Sahin and Ramosha Feinstein became the two leaders and policy setters for Aguda and the American Haredi world. See, if you think about it, the exponential growth of the Haredi yeshivish world over the last 40, 50 years, that today roughly 70% of American Orthodoxy, is no doubt due in part to his guidance and his policies, especially in education. Yeah, the growth of the Hasidic communities is another, it's not related to him. He took a balanced, nuanced view of the state of Israel. So he wasn't a Zionist, but he wasn't an anti-Zionist kanoi. And in line with his personality, he saw the state as valuable, as a means to rescue Jews, and he recognized the Hashgacha in various aspects of the state, even declaring the Six-Day War, Nisim b'Niflos. So it's reasonable to us, mother's milk to us, but it's not at all a uniform view in the Haredi world then or now. And he traveled frequently to Israel for conferences. He met with several prime ministers on behalf of the Moetzes. He was especially impressed with Menachem Begin. He said, he's a Yiddish mensch. His insights were always compelling. One of the most famous Rabbi Yaakov stories, everyone tells this one, we'll be done in a minute. He flew once back from Israel, and he sat on the plane next to Yerucham Meshel, who was then the head, the Secretary General of the Histadrut, old-time socialist atheist. So Meshel noticed, every half hour or so, a man would walk over, a young woman would walk over, ask him if he needs anything, fluff his pillow, etc. As they're flying, Meshel asked him, "Who are these people? Why do you get this treatment?" And Rabbi Yaakov said, "One's my son and one's my granddaughter." To which Meshel confessed that he only rarely saw his own children and grandchildren. They didn't want much to do with him. So Rabbi Yaakov explained to him, "Yeah, I'll tell you why. You believe in Darwin, so in your children's eyes, you're just one generation closer to the apes than they are. So why should they feel they have to respect you? But for us, the central event in history was when God spoke to the Jewish people at Sinai, the revelation. So my children and grandchildren honor me as being closer to that revelation. They see me as someone who had contact with spiritual giants that's beyond their comprehension, and so they attribute to me a wisdom that they lack. I try to pass that on to them, but that's why they respect me." He appreciated the United States, but he felt Jews should not be demonstrative in public. Always remember, we're still in exile. He said the servitude in Egypt did not begin until all of Yaakov's sons died, because they didn't need to be reminded that Egypt was not their land. They knew it wasn't. Not so their children and grandchildren. He was instrumental in guiding Torah Masorah. He was one of the founders, the founder maybe, Be'er HaGolah in the 70s, to give a Torah education to young refugee children started coming from the Soviet Union. He oversaw the establishment of Kolim across America. He was indispensable in what really is the Torah revolution of the last 40 years, the Art Scroll series. It was Rabbi Yaakov who told these two people who managed a graphics company that made invitations, Art Scroll, after they published a commentary on Megillas Esther as a shloshim for one of their friends, Rabbi Yaakov said, "Now you have to continue, because English has become the language of Torah, and you have to produce Torah volumes in English for this generation. It's a revolution." He had tremendous love for children. He would spend his summers in camp with them, his own children, dozens of grandchildren, great-grandchildren, all Marbitzei Torah across America, across the world. Many of them you don't know because they don't have the name Kamenetsky. His son Reb Shmuel is Reb Shiv in Philadelphia. His late son Reb Yamin is Reb Shiv in Yulit. His late son Reb Nosson was the founder of Itri. His father-in-law was Reb David Lifshitz, so the two of them were Mechutonim. His daughters married rabbis. And after he left Harvard Das, that's when he published a whole series of Emes LeYaakov on Chumash and many, many Masechtos and Shas. He was extremely courteous to all, Jew and non-Jew, cultured in speech and behavior. At bar mitzvahs, he urged the boy to speak first. Get out of his system. Get rid of the nervousness. He could join the rest of the party. He was asked once why he lived a long life, and he said it was a gift from God to use to help other people. Everything was with Musar. He was once walking to a mailbox in Muncie to mail a letter, and a bacha ran out and asked if he could mail it for Rabbi Yaakov. And Rabbi Yaakov answered, "No, thank you. It's a utility bill, and paying it is part of the mitzvah of Priyas Chov, of paying your debts. So I have to perform this mitzvah." So he declined, but he taught a midah in one word. And he was tolerant, and he could talk to people with whom he disagreed. He never had a shamus or a gatekeeper. Anybody could knock on his door at his home in Muncie and see him. He was an accessible gadol. It was said of him that he wanted to be treated like a real person because he was a real person. A stroke weakened him in 1984, and he died 1986, age 95, buried in Mount Judah Cemetery in Ridgewood, Queens. It was a terrible 2 weeks for Klal Yisrael. He died the end of Adar Aleph, and then 2 weeks later, 13 days later, Moshe Feinstein died. And Rav Yaakov was eulogized as the Pikeach Hador, as the Hakima de Yehudai, the wise man of the Jews, a kluger yid, a true successor to his Rebbe, the Alter Slobodka, and a Baal Eitza par excellence. I do not know if Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a successor. Yehi zichro baruch. I thank you all very much.